I think they thought that there was absolutely no way, regardless of their own personal views, and I mean, I'm not suggesting actually that any of them did have any different personal views. I think they all went along with it personally as well as professionally. But I don't think there was ever any point at which anyone thought, oh, no, I don't think this is right. I think they honestly were that caught up in it. And I can say that with some degree of authority, okay, only on a sort of single constabulary basis. But I wrote, if you like, I've also got my the pretext of my resignation to my constabulary. And this was obviously, you know, having described what I described, I wasn't policing during 2020, during the sort of drone and supermarket madness, but the you know, the 2021 sort of mask and six people in a garden and then the jab thing. So a different kind of madness. But I think where it went was increasingly awful. And the tipping point for me was, and I, sorry, this is rather technical, but it was a statutory instrument that came out at the end of 2021. It was December 2021, statutory instrument 1416, which was the venue entry requirements, which effectively was the vaccine passport thing. And when you swear your oath of allegiance, you talk about people's human rights, you talk about fairness, impartiality, integrity, all those sorts of things. And yet here we were, apparently in a position where, according to some utterly sort of nebulous criteria, we were going to tell some people in society that they were better than other people. And there really was absolutely no justification for doing it, and less still justification for policing it. And so my concern was sort of at least twofold. One was that it was an abhorrent thing to be doing to society, or at least to be proposing to do in society, to actually walk, sort of say, up and down the queue of a nightclub and hoy somebody out if they didn't have a vaccine passport. And we'll come on to what that means in a minute. And then the second thing was the incredibly damaging potential it had to the relationship between the police and the public, the sort of PR exercise. You look at what was going on in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Austria, Germany, where they had already cut people in two, cut society in two, and you know there were pitch battles, and I didn't want to see that. I didn't want to see colleagues of mine going into potentially harmful situations because of what they had decided to do off the back of bad law. So you know there were lots of different elements to it. So I wrote to my chief constable, is therefore, you know, sort of leapfrog the entire chain of command, not to be a pain in the backside, but because it simply wasn't understood at any lower level, and nor was it considered to be something that was within their gift to do anything about. So I wrote, "Dear Chief Constable, I appreciate that it is irregular to get in touch with you directly, but these are most certainly irregular times. I'm writing as a concerned colleague as well as a member of the public that I serve. In light of the continued encroachment of the UK government into the private lives of citizens, I'm writing to ask if there are any circumstances under which you will employ or direct the constabulary to effect a division or segregation of society. The House of Commons votes tomorrow on the likely introduction of an instrument of discrimination and the beginnings of a de facto social credit system. At the moment, this presents itself as ordinary participation in society becoming contingent upon the consumption of the product of a profit-seeking pharmaceutical company. This might seem dramatic, and I would hazard a guess that you have not been asked this until now. And yet, despite the efforts of the commercial media channels to suppress it, I am watching as police help create a two-tier society in the countries of our friends and allies in the Commonwealth and European nations of Canada, New Zealand, Australia, Austria, Germany and France, to name a few. If you are able to answer with an unequivocal no, is the Home Office aware of the constabulary's position? If the answer is not an unequivocal no, may I ask when and how colleagues will be told that they are to take part in the introduction of apartheid in the UK? I think you are in a very unenviable position, but that the right course of action is clear. I would be very pleased to discuss this with you face to face."
So, that's a cracker of a letter, Charles. How long did that take you to write?
I can't quite remember, but yeah, I probably went through a couple of drafts.
It's good. Not a word wasted. Anyway, so what happened?
Not a word wasted. Was it interesting you should choose that phrase? Because, do you know, it honestly wasn't understood. What I meant was not understood by the people that read it. And it was read, it went round the whole of the chief officer group, so the chief constable plus the assistants and deputies, the chief of staff, and they honestly didn't know what I was driving at. So that shows, and I know, and I can think of the, you know, your early days, I know it persists, but your many, many sort of London calling conspiracy or cock-up sort of debates.
Yeah.
These guys didn't understand what they were doing. And I'm not saying that puts blame away from them. It absolutely doesn't. They hadn't sought to understand what they were doing. So not only had they decided they were just going to police absolutely every element of it, they were going to take whatever was thrown at them, they weren't even going to think of the consequences of doing that.
Can I just check with you, which you're referring to your oath that you, well, first of all,
yeah,
to whom are you swearing the oath? Is it to, so the oath, to the government or to the monarch?
No, it's to the monarch.
Is it?
So yeah, it was changed. The oath was changed. The Police Reform Act of 2002. So they interestingly, because the previous oath had included the phrases to police without favour or affection, malice or ill will, and basically took that out and put in the notion of fundamental human rights. And everybody thinks, oh, yeah, wonderful. You know, those human rights, they are enshrined in law, and thank goodness for it. And I'm afraid the Human Rights Act 1998 is not worth the paper it's written on. It is absolutely shocking. You know, human rights, for those listening who might not have necessarily and perfectly understandably a grasp of exactly what's sort of meant by them, at least in the state that they're written down. But effectively, human rights are split into three different categories. They are either absolute, which means that there shouldn't be any conditions under which there's a challenge presented to them, or limited, which means there are certain situations in which that particular right or freedom can be limited or qualified. So they exist unless such and such happens. And, you know, this is ages old. Is it, 1998 is in effect a lifetime ago. You know, there's the age of terror. And yet people seem to have totally overlooked the fact that all these rights are qualified. And I'll just, you know, just to quote, the right to liberty and security is qualified by the lawful detention of persons for the prevention of the spreading of infectious diseases of persons of unsound mind, alcoholics or drug addicts or vagrants. The right to respect for a family life, which is Article 8, can be qualified by accordance with law and is necessary in a democratic society in the interest of national security, public safety or the economic well-being of the country, for the prevention of disorder and crime, for the protection of health or morals, or right, for the protection of rights and freedoms of others. So, you know, the in a way, the changing of the oath by the Reform Act was quite clever, because, of course, to say that you're protecting people's fundamental human rights sounds brilliant, but means nothing, or at least means that people can still do, the government can still do exactly as they please.
It's actually, I think, Charles, that it's not clever, it's diabolical. And I think you'd understand that.
It is. It is diabolical. And a lot of it, you know, I'm not sort of blaming anyone, because I'm absolutely as much to blame for this as the next person. But all this has been there for years. The Public Health Act was drawn up in 1984. The provisions within the Public Health Act, which luckily we haven't actually seen affect themselves over the last 3 years because they invented the Coronavirus Act. But, you know, the Public Health Act is absolutely appalling, the provisions it makes. The same thing with the Public Order Act, 1986. You know, these have been around for a long time, and yet it's only now that people are beginning to get alive to the fact that these sorts of laws exist.
Well, because...
So, anyway, yeah, go on.
The people who plan these things, they have a long time to do it.
Yeah.
They plan sort of in generations rather than in the short term way we think. which is why they're always getting one over us. But tell me, which that letter to your chief constable, which, how were you in breach of your oath? Well, you talked about apartheid.
So I'll tell you why. Because well, first of all, the fundamental principle, and this accords to what's referred to as the doctrine of the lesser magistrates, which is in effect that if you're confronted by bad law, it is your duty to either disregard it or interpose yourself in some way as to nullify that particular point of law. So therefore, as a police constable, if dealing with what is bad law, law that is not natural, law that does not conform to the natural laws, then it should be disregarded.
Is that written into your oath, or how is that understood?
No, again, of course not. No, because it's far too powerful. No, the way to, and again, for people listening, the doctrine of the lesser magistrates goes back for years to the sort of time of Knox and Calvin, written sort of formally enshrined by the pastors of Magdeburg in Germany. And if you want to read it, there's a very good book produced by Matthew Trewella, who's an American, written in 2013. I'll just show it up to the camera for people who are watching. Written in 2013, Matthew Trewella, which is spelt T-R-E-W-H-E-L-L-A. It's very easily available online, but it's set out very clearly, you know, that this sort of thing should not happen. If bad law exists, it should be challenged by those within the system.
How is that binding when you become a policeman?
Yeah.
Or how is that principle binding?
In effect, you're sort of, partly through discretion, partly through duty, you're not meant to conduct anything that's unlawful. So you have to effectively take it on good faith that if you either fail to do something or do something because of your beliefs, and you're then challenged over that by the system, you should hope that the next chain above you, the magistrates or the county court or whatever, would see it that it was bad law and it would go up the chain and be overturned. That's effectively how it works. So an example of that, to a sort of extent, is jury nullification, which is when a judge would direct a jury to either to convict or not to convict, and a jury would disregard that because they held a particular belief about the case, and they would decide one way or the other, contrary to that. I mean, you know, law does get overturned. Statute law does get overturned.
Oh no! Listen, I'm totally with you. I love the idea of jury nullification. Although I doubt it's
a double-edged sword. Actually, it's a double-edged sword. Very much a double-edged sword.
But just sorry to pin you down on this. So
yeah,
you're effectively holding your chief constable to account, saying, look, you are about to, but by creating this two-tier policing system where one class of people, the jabbed or the acquiescent or the surrenderers or whatever, they are given privileged status over people who don't want to take part in this experiment. I see why there was room for your principled objection. What I'm saying is, in what way does that...
Why does it breach the oath?
Yeah.
It breaches the oath, I would say, for several reasons. First of all, you're not dealing with people with fairness, integrity, diligence, and impartiality. Mm-hmm. You're definitely not doing any of those things. And the reason for that, to go into the technicalities, is that if you remember, it was to do with not whether you'd received the vaccine, it was whether you had the vaccine passport. And you were eligible for the vaccine passport if you had had a medical exemption or if you took part in a trial. So there were basically four groups of people existed in society: people who had had the injection and people who had, you know, taken the passport to demonstrate that, people who had a medical exemption but were still eligible for the passport, people who had taken part in a trial, still had the passport, or people that simply decided they didn't want to take it. So you had four groups of people, three of which hadn't had the injection, But only one of those groups was prohibited from doing all the things. So that's not fair. And also it has absolutely nothing to do with what they call health, public health, safety, any of those sorts of things. So yeah. It's a complete red herring, not least because there were several very significant exemptions in this statutory instrument. Amazingly, and if we're to go along with the premise in this case, which is to do with, you know, infectious disease, so reducing human contact, that's what it seemed to be all about. And yet, exemptions were granted for staff at venues. So if you imagine that somebody, if we have our infectious disease model, somebody standing on the door of a football ground or a nightclub, infecting every single person as they go in. And yet that was perfectly legitimate under the statutory instrument. Completely ridiculous. And then also, you know, a long list of people, police officers, diplomats, officers, you know, holders of X, Y and Z, offices of state, environmental officers, local authority officers, all the rest of it were exempt.
Just one other thing. You describe it as a statutory instrument.
Yeah.
How obliged are police? I mean, was it even legal? What was it enforceable?
Well, that's getting into a sort of separate minefield, and then we get into really. I mean, that's a long, long discussion because then you're getting into legal or lawful. And whether something is, you know, whether something's written down in statute or not, whether it's effectively sort of a law of the land, and we're getting into the difference between common law and statutes and all those sorts of things. So, but no, I mean, secondary legislation, statutory instruments, are, I suppose, less likely to attract criminal sanctions, but that's not to say that they can't. In fairness, I wouldn't want to go too much into detail without researching it further. You'd be better off talking to somebody,
to somebody
practices law. Yeah, exactly.
I've resisted the temptation so far to go down that rabbit hole precisely for that.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah.